We're beginning Parashat Vayeshev. There's a lot to discuss and a little amount of time. We'll try to cover as best as we can. We know the storyline more or less. Yosef is orphaned. He's 17 years old. He's good looking. His father makes him an exceptional coat. The brothers are jealous. Yosef keeps telling bad things about them. He has dreams about how he's going to be king. The brothers get jealous. Yaakov tries yelling at him. It doesn't help. The brothers are still jealous. And so they decide they're going to sell him. They throw him into a pit. They sell him. He's taken down to Egypt. And the brothers come back and bring the torn garment. They say, look what we found. It's covered with blood. Yaakov is convinced Yosef's been devoured by wild animals. And Yosef, meanwhile, is sold into slavery into Egypt. Yehuda goes and marries, has three kids. The first one gets married. He's sinful with his wife. The second one marries her. The first one dies. The second one marries her. Same story. Doesn't want to have kids to maintain his wife's beauty. Uses birth control. He drops dead. Yehuda doesn't know what's going on. He just sees his two sons dying. So Yehuda tells her, wait around until the third one grows older. He's a little concerned what will happen to him. And then she sees that it's a game. He's not really planning on doing it. And so she gets all dressed up and she seduces Yehuda. And then she gets pregnant. And Yehuda's convinced that she's been unfaithful. So in those days, the custom was a woman got the death penalty for that. She doesn't want to embarrass him publicly. She says, here's the sign of who I was with. And Yehuda stands up publicly and says, it's me, it's my kids, I'm the one. And in those days, the custom was that the bride who was widowed can marry anyone in the family. The deal was she had to remain in the family. So Yehuda marries her and they have two kids from whom the Mashiach comes. Unusual story. Yosef's down in Egypt and Potiphar's wife tries to seduce him. He refuses. One day she grabs him when no one's around and he slips out of his robe. He runs out naked and she yells, look at what he tried to do to me. Look at him. What a bum. What a... Oh. Yosef gets incarcerated for 12 years and in prison Pharaoh's two advisors, the two servants, the bread maker and the butler, they're both incarcerated. They both have dreams. Yosef interprets them correctly that the butler will be reinstated in 3 days and the bread maker will be killed in 3 days, and that's what happens. And that's the end of the parasha. The butler forgets Yosef and Yosef is stuck in jail for a total of 12 years, 2 more years at the end of the parasha, 10 in the beginning, and then 2 until next week's parasha when he's taken out of jail. Butler Sal Mashkim. Parshas Vayeshev. So we have a decree. God tells Avram, your descendants will be strangers in this land. And Yaakov has suffered so terribly. No one else suffered like Yaakov. None of the patriarchs suffered like him. They had their wives taken. He had his daughter raped. They had their wives pass away at an old age. He had his young wife Rachel and they in her 30s die. And then Leah die. And he has to bring up all these orphans. They had wars which were miraculous victories. He had strange victories where his sons go behind his back and kill out the city of Shechem. He's endangered by everyone. And things are really rough on Yaakov. He has a brother who wants to kill him. He has to work really hard. The other patriarchs were super wealthy. And he has to work really hard. And he's tricked all the time. And he has a father-in-law that wants him dead. He has a brother that wants him dead. And now he finally comes back. He's settled next to his father's territory. He's made peace with Esav. Esav takes his family out to Mount Seir. They agree that Yaakov will settle over there. Everything seems like it can fall into place. He's minus at least one wife. He's lost Rachel. But he can settle down and develop his family, focus on his family. And God says, no, you don't. Life does not pass by peacefully. One of the weaknesses we have in life is that we're always looking for that punchline, they lived happily ever after. We imagine that we're supposed to reach a point of serenity. People think, I'm a bachelor, I'll get married, things will be calm. You get married and suddenly it's fireworks. We'll be married a decade, it'll calm down. Okay, then you have the kids driving you crazy. They'll grow up. Then they become teenagers. They'll grow up. Then they get married and you have those. They'll grow up. Then you have grandchildren you have to worry about and they're not sure how they're going to make ends meet. And life is a series of adventures. Now, you can view those adventures as a horror story. Why? What's going on here? Or you can view those adventures as, okay, we gotta make it work. I'll tell you a quick story. I'll skip many details just to keep it really quick. I was invited by the army after I made Aliyah. They tell me I'm supposed to come in. I fill in the papers. They tell me you're too old. You have too many kids. We don't want you. We're putting you on reserves. Fine. Go down and get the papers. I'm sitting downstairs waiting for the papers. And after about 10 minutes, I asked the secretary down there, I don't want to disturb you. I just want a picture. Do you have any idea when I'm getting the papers so I can go? And she tells me, you ain't going nowhere, buddy. I said, what do you mean? She says, we know all about you, and they're on their way to take you, and the prison is waiting for you, so just sit tight, and everything will be okay. I'm like, huh? And I was wondering if the guy upstairs was honest with me. You know, he made it too simple when he said, we don't want you, everything's okay. I asked myself, is he playing a trick on me? You know, and he kept smiling, this friendly smile. And I kept wondering, what's he smiling about? And he says, we don't want you, we don't need you, you go home, everything's okay. I said, I don't want to go home, I want a piece of paper that says what you just said. So he said, okay, go down, the secretary will give it to you. So okay, I go down, and suddenly, 10 minutes later, I discover they're on their way. So I say, you know, could be there was some kind of mistake here. She says, no mistake, buddy. You sit tight and you'll have a nice prison cell for a month. And then you'll go and do your service like you should. Well, you've been hiding all this time. Now, huh? I don't know. Okay, so I try saying something and she says, shh, go sit down. Okay, so sitting down and I'm wondering, do I get one last phone call? You know, I'm sitting down. I'm wondering, I'm about to be taken for prison. I don't even know what I did. You know, and I remember the thought going through my mind. And I'm saying to myself, my wife thinks I'm going to be home later today. Am I supposed to pick up the kids today? Who's picking up the kids? Will I have a chance to call? I think my cell phone battery just died then. Like I didn't know. I'm thinking, this isn't how I thought today would play itself out, right? I had plans what I'm learning this afternoon, and now I'm watching, and I'm wondering if I end up in jail, I don't even know why, but if I end up in jail, this is interesting. She wasn't into talking to me. This wasn't like part of what she thought she should be doing. So I remember sitting back, smiling to myself and saying, you know you didn't do anything wrong, as far as you know, and you're not in control at this moment. You're going to see what you can do to get out of this. But at the end of the day, there are scenarios where sit back and remember you don't run every aspect of your life. Sometimes surprises happen and you're going to have to make the best of it. So I start looking through my bag. I'm wondering which safer do I have? You know, if I'm going to be in jail, I wonder which safer I'm going to be able to learn. You know, what am I going to do with this time? You know, I remember looking and saying to myself, take it calmly. Sometimes in life, you're not the boss. Someone else is running the show. I waited 5 minutes till the secretary calmed down. And then I said to you, you know, I don't want to disturb you. I understand you're busy. But the guy upstairs told me you're supposed to give me papers and send me home. Could it be you're confusing me with someone else? I know you think this way, but let's just check. Do you mind if I go upstairs and check with him? So she says, okay, go upstairs, but don't try running out because I'm going to get the guards to get you. So I say, okay, I'm not running out. I'm going to go, you know. I'll go up, fine. I go up and I come to him and he says, sorry, I just got to go. And he's running the other way. So that like really looked suspicious. I said, look, I understand you got to go, but if I'm going to go to jail, just tell me, is that really what's supposed to happen or is there a misunderstanding? So he stops in his tracks and says, go to jail? Why would you go to jail? No. So I said, well, the girl downstairs thinks she's supposed to send me to jail. So he said, oh, she's confusing you with the other guy I sent downstairs. You're not supposed to go to jail. I'm just going to the restroom. I'll be back in 5 minutes and I'll take care of it. Okay, I got all time in the world. I'm not going to jail. I can handle that, right? Okay, fine. End of story. But I remember the feeling sitting there for 10 minutes thinking I'm headed to jail and saying, okay, I don't run the show. We have to be prepared to say that in life. Sometimes we look at life and we say, let me have peace. Let me have tranquility. Let life settle down. And life doesn't work that way. Life is a series of adventures. If you're not dealing with the Aliyah office, you're dealing with other offices. Probably the calmest time of your life is now. You don't have a wife and kids, and as hard as things are relatively calm. You know, if you've made a certain small amount of money during the week or month, you can make ends meet, and there are very few responsibilities. Okay, things get more exciting from here. They get more hectic. And there's that desire to settle down, and it's a normal desire, but we have to be prepared for the excitements of life. And every person has a few major excitements in their life. Major, I mean, issues that can be life-threatening. It could be life-threatening to oneself, to one's relatives. It can be major that one loses their finances. It can be major that a hurricane strikes. No one goes through life without major issues. You look at people and you think their life seems placid. That seems calm. That's beautiful. You don't know. It's only people who you don't know that have calm lives. Once you know what's going on in people's lives, you start realizing, no, it's not as simple as you think. So everyone's dealing, and we have to be prepared for it. You pray that when these huge things happen in your life, you walk away with minor scars. But usually there are scars.
What is minor
scars? Minor? Minor scars. Salakot ktanot. You pray that it should be minor, but everyone has a few major things in their life, and then the regular adventures of life. There was a time that one kid asked me to pour him a cup of tea, so I poured in the hot water, and I went to get the tea bag, and the little one, we didn't realize she could reach up on the table, she pulled down the cup. So there was only a small amount of boiling water in the cup, and it trickled all the way down the table and got her shirt wet, and she starts yelling her head off. And we couldn't figure out what she was yelling for, because it was a small amount of water, and it trickled all the way down the table before it hit her. It took us about 10 seconds to figure out that she was burning her chest. Until we took off her shirt and took off everything, she had already a second-degree burn on her chest, and we had to run to the hospital and spend the next few months putting on creams on her until she got better. Okay. It happens. I mean, you don't realize that the kid's being burned. It takes you time to understand why she's wailing. You look and you don't see. Okay. At the time, there was a woman who met us as we were on our way to the hospital to have her treated. And she said, I know you're getting excited now, but I want you to know that these are the things you should pray for. I said, what? She said, this is normal. As a parent, when a kid breaks a hand, it's normal. When a kid has a hernia, it's normal. When it's a small burn on the chest, it's normal. You pray that life should be filled with normal adventures. It's not fun, but it's normal. You pray not to be the one who's in the oncology ward. You pray not to be the one with other major issues. These are small, normal issues of life. Deal with them and be thankful you have them. And at the time, I said, I'll digest it later. You know, I wasn't ready to digest it just then. When 6 years later, she was diagnosed with a cancer of the pancreas, which is basically uncurable, then I realized how right she was. You know, she kept telling me, when my children break their limbs, I say, thank you, God. Thank you that I'm busy as being a normal parent. This is normal. We can deal. We can handle. Yaakov Avinu has had extraordinary challenges. Nothing here is normal. A brother that wants to kill him, a father-in-law that wants to kill him, spending 20 years on a job where you're being conned for 20 years straight, being conned out of the wife you mean to marry, having a daughter that's raped, having two sons starting a war. Every one of these issues are catastrophic. Every one of these are major. And so it's normal that Yaakov, he loses his wife. And that's what I said. You pray that when the big things happen in life, you walk away with relatively minor scars. You always walk away with scars. The question is how major. Yaakov Avinu is walking away with some very serious scars. His daughter Dina is never going to get married. His granddaughter from Dina is being raised outside of the house. The wife, Rachel, is dead. The son, Benjamin, has to be raised as an orphan. There are major scars. And so when Yaakov says, I want a break, it's not like he wants a vacation. It's that Yaakov wants to settle down and focus on his family. He has a lot of Torah to teach them. There's a whole tradition to teach them. You want to develop things, you need peace. Like the Rambam writes in a letter. He says, people compare me to my predecessors. There's no way I don't compare. Because I don't have the peace of mind to compare. I can't. I don't have the peace of mind to learn like my father did or his father did. So I'm nowhere near them. So Yaakov has an orphan, a son by the name of Yosef, who is much smarter than all his brothers. And he grasps things that none of them do. And when he makes them each a coat, he gives Yosef a coat with one strip around the sleeve. It's not that Yosef gets this fancy coat and everyone else got a little beige nothing. Everyone got the same blue blazer. Yosef's had one strip of red string around the sleeve. But you know what? When everyone's wearing the blue, and he's got the blue with the red strip, that's enough to make everyone feel different. And Chazal, on the simplest level, say, Lo lamal yeshane adam bno ben abanim, never treat one son different. But he's smarter. and he's more responsible, and he knows what he's doing better than they do. And when they're all shepherding the sheep, he can come in and cure all the sheep that are ill. None of them can. And he can look at the way they're shepherding the sheep and say, you know, if you took the sheep at this hour of the day to that part of the field, and that out part of the day to that part of the field, the sheep would be healthier, they'd produce better milk, we'd make more money, you'd have to work less. And he's right. Meaning he's a phenomenal organizer. You see it later, he saves the whole world when he's running Egypt. That's not a small feat. You know, to manage the infrastructure, to manage the army, to manage the economy, to manage that layman, agrarian who can't even read, and instruct them how to grow the crops properly and take off taxes properly and then store them properly and then ensure that people aren't robbing them blind. You know, Yosef could be the most brilliant man in the world, but if there's a lot of anarchy in his system, he's going to lose all that money. But no, everything's very organized. Yosef's brilliant. He really is a super genius. And when Yaakov tries teaching all the kids, the one who gets it best is Yosef. And Yosef really was supposed to be the leader of all the brothers. It's true, Yehuda was the mighty warrior. Yehuda was the king. But Yosef is smarter than all of them. He's got this brilliance that none of them have. As smart and as wonderful as they all were. And even though halachically Yehuda was right more often than Yosef, but Yosef was a super genius. And so Yaakov instructs him as the leader. And don't forget that Yosef is the prime son. It is for Yosef that Yaakov married. Yaakov wed with the intention of having children from Rachel. Everyone else was forced on him. He didn't want any of it. So he has a responsibility. They're his children. He raises them. He loves them. But who's his firstborn son? Yosef. Who was his chosen wife? Rachel. So Yaakov says, fine, he's smarter than everyone else. He has the capacity to run everyone else, to lead the show here. Yes, I'm giving him the responsibility, and if he's the responsible one, there are certain perks that come with it. And the other brothers blow a gut. They're not ready for this. And so Chazal say, even when one kid is smarter than the others, and even when one kid is more skilled than the others, you got to be super careful and not treat one kid different than the others. If suddenly he's the prime son, everyone else goes to watch the sheep, and he just shows up to check how they're all doing. He's not out there with them when they're shepherding the sheep. So he's better than that. He's bigger than that. It's true. Yosef was on a higher level than the rest of them. But you see what happened. It doesn't work. You run a family. Even if one can outdo the other, you got to find a way to keep them equals. There are parents, sometimes as parents you'll see, you want to teach your kids English, okay? Your kids are learning Hebrew in school, you want to teach them English. And you notice that the second or third kid is much smarter than the first or second. The younger kid is going to grasp it much quicker than the older kid, so then maybe you postpone teaching that kid. Because if you'll teach them together, he'll make the older one feel stupid. And the older one needs his time to learn. So sometimes you say, I'll teach you in a year when you'll be older. I, the younger one, can attain it. Right. But who said you should develop that aspect of that child at the expense of the other one? Find other things to develop. The younger child doesn't have to lose either, but you can find other ways to develop the younger child. It takes tremendous thought. But the thought has to be focused in that direction. How do I let each kid develop their skills without one kid hurting the other? Yaakov comes to teach Torah. Yosef is more skilled than the rest. Yaakov comes to teach him how to run a country, a government, a people. Yosef gets it all. They don't. So they get it, but not on the level of Yosef. And that's why Yosef has dreams of leadership. And he's right in his dreams. And he's right in his interpretation of the dreams. Yosef dreams of all the bundles bowing down to him. He's 100% right. He's going to feed all of them. It's all going to come true. But he tells it over. And when he tells it over, so everyone gets jealous. You're going to lead us? You're going to rule us by force? Just because you think you're going to have control of the economy? He's right, that's exactly what's going to happen. But they're not willing to hear it. So, Yosef has this dream, and dreams can be prophetic. And Yosef understands, and his father understands, that this dream is prophetic. This has to happen. But the brothers refuse to understand. So they hate him even more. Remember in last week's parsha when Rachel died, so Yaakov comes the next morning and he finds his bed has been shifted into Leah's tent. He doesn't know who did it. Reuven did it, right? Who goes and tells him? Yosef. The pasuk says Yosef spoke badly about his brothers. The brothers are treating the sons of the maids differently. Well, you know what? They saw it by their father. Yaakov treated them differently, right? You see it when Yaakov sets them up for the meeting with Esav. So in Yaakov's mind, they were all his sons, but they weren't all on the same level. Yaakov differentiates. So Yosef comes to the father and says, you know, it's not right. They're not treating them nicely. You made a certain differentiation, however you factored it. But did you really mean that for the rest of our lives, we should treat them differently? And so Yosef goes out of his way to be kind to them. But the brothers, they're upset at Yosef. What are you doing going to dad about this? And so Yosef might be right, but Yosef's actions are going to backfire. There happens to be many halachic arguments between the brothers. The brothers found halachic loopholes for dealing with meat and milk, situations where it would be permissible for eating an animal without slaughtering it. And Yosef comes in and sees them doing that, and he comes to his dad and says, what's going on here? Is this the way we're supposed to behave? And so Yaakov comes back to the kids and says, this isn't right. But you understand that this breeds enmity. And the brothers feel there's this discord between them and their father. They know that their father Yaakov knew that Grandpa Yitzchak misappropriated his blessings, right? Yitzchak thought Esav was the pious one, and he was wrong. The brothers know, they know the story, right? So their dad thinks Yosef is the pious one. They look at the story and they say, no, he's got it all wrong. Yosef is the Esav of the family. And it's true. Yosef has traits that none of them have which can stand up to Esav. Yosef is the one that will stand up to Esav, and Yosef is the one that does stand up to Esav, even in last week's parsha. But the brothers, they see the correlation between Yosef and Esav. So they decide, well, when dad did things, he did it behind his father's back, right? We've come to the conclusion Yosef has to be bumped out. If there was a decree that one of us has that the people that dad's descendants have to be in Egypt as slaves, let him go be a slave. He should be a slave. It'll teach him something. He thinks he's above everyone. The best medicine he should be out there is a slave. He thinks he's one of us. He's not one of us. He's broken the pact with all of us. He snitches on us. He speaks badly about us. He doesn't see himself as one of us. He's different. Okay. He's not. And dad doesn't see the truth. He thinks he sees. He doesn't see. And so the brothers are slowly forming an opinion, Yosef is not one of the tribes. He's not. He doesn't deserve to be a part of all of this. He's not going the way that a Jew should behave. So the brothers go out to shepherd the sheep, and they go to dangerous territory. They're going to Shechem. Now, Shechem is an area where they have many enemies. You know, they didn't kill everyone. There were people who escaped. There were people who weren't in town when they did all of this. And so Yaakov's concerned. He says, you know, they've gone to Shechem. I haven't heard from them. I want you to go see that they're okay. Yaakov says, I want you to see how they're doing. I want you to see how the sheep are doing. I want you to bring me back word. And so he starts walking. He wasn't little. He was 17. But that's a good point, right? That's a discussion in the commentaries. That's a good point. That's true. He starts walking with him. And Yosef says, Abba, enough, I know the way. And his father says, no, there's a halacha in the Torah called Egla Arufa. When a person is found murdered, and no one knows how he was murdered, so the elders come out of the city, and they bring a calf, and they cut off its head, and they do this whole procession, and they say, we did not let this guy leave our city without accompanying him. This guy did not leave with the feeling that he was alone to face the world. From there we learn halacha that when a guest leaves your house, when someone leaves your house, you walk with them, Yosef. I'm walking with you. Remember that. A person is by you, you accompany them. They don't walk alone. You don't wave your guest goodbye from the table. You're leaving, I'm walking with you. And he continues accompanying Yosef. And Yosef will remember this the rest of his life. The last lesson his father taught him is not only do you help a person, but you give the person the feeling that even after he leaves your house, you're with him. You care. And you cause that departure to be later, a minute later, 2 minutes later, by walking them a little bit. Interesting story. Rav Micha Hyman told me that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, when someone visited him, so that person records that as he was leaving, Rav Yaakov stood there like a little boy waving goodbye until the car was out of sight. So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, he was the one who was guiding the whole education system in the United States after World War II. He had better things to do than stand there waving goodbye. But that's Dachnas Asorchim. That's how Chazal wanted us to walk our guests goodbye. So that's the final message that Yaakov's going to teach Yosef. You got to give someone else the feeling you're with them even after they've left your house. And Yosef's going to remember that. That's going to be with him all the way 22 years in Egypt. So, Yosef heads for the brothers. And they're not where he thinks they'll be. And God sends an angel to guide Yosef. And this is one place that we see, it's almost staring at you in the verse. It says, a man found Yosef. It doesn't say Yosef found the man. Yosef's looking, and the pasuk says, a man found him. Who's this man? What's he finding him for? And the man asks him, what are you looking for? And Yosef says, I'm looking for my brothers. Great, who are you? Why don't you introduce yourself? No, it's enough to say I'm looking for my brothers. And the man, and he tells him, can you please tell me where they're shepherding the sheep? And the man says, they've left this. I heard him saying they're going to Dothan. And so Yosef goes there to Dothan. So here our sages tell us this man was an angel who came to direct Yosef because the continuation of the story is part of God's plan for the world. There are places in Jewish history where our sages say God was focused on having this happen. The sin of Adam, Adam Arishon, eating the forbidden fruit, was part of God's plan. It was supposed to happen. The sin of the Jewish people with the golden calf was part of God's plan. The story that's about to transpire between Yosef and his brothers is also part of God's plan. So, the brothers see Yosef from a distance. Yosef's heading towards them. He's way out in the field. They can't hear one another, but they can see one another. And Yosef waves. He's coming. And the brothers don't wave back. They start talking to one another. There's that guy, the dreamer. He's coming. And he thinks that all of us are worthless. He's the future of Israel. Let's kill him and leave him here. Because the way he is portraying us to Dad, what can happen now is that we will all be bumped out of Judaism. And he, the son of Rachel, only he and Yosef will remain. So right now he's threatening all of our future. We have halacha that when someone threatens someone else's life, if someone's coming to kill you, kill him first. If someone's coming to beat you, beat him first. Right? It's halacha. You don't have to wait till someone smacks you. Someone walks into the room. I teach this to my kids too. It's halacha and choshen mishpat. You know, someone's coming to beat you up, so hit him back. Hit him first. Don't let him hit you. He's about to hit you, so defend yourself. It's not only about life and death, but the brothers feel like Yosef is threatening their lives. The brothers feel like this is way beyond a question of just speaking badly about us. He is portraying us in a way, look at what's happening. We're out with the sheep, and he's home learning Torah by Dad. Where's this all headed to? So the brothers feel like Yosef's a critical threat to them. And they start discussing it. And Shimon speaks to Levi, and he says, there's the dreamer. Let's kill him. I'll draw the bow. We'll shoot him. We can hit him from here. And then they have a bunch of dogs. Wild dogs. Dogs that are meant to fend off wild animals from the sheep. And Shimon tells Levi, I'll hit him by a bow. Levi says, no, sick the wild dogs at him. Yosef is approaching. And the dogs don't touch him.
Who is Yosef oblivious of this?
And Yosef is unaware of what's about to transpire.
Is this Porcher? Yosef is a Porcher, you said, but Yosef
approaching, mitkarev. Yosef is coming, and the big brother Reuven, who's been hurt worse than anyone else by Yosef. Because when Yosef went to Yaakov and told him that Reuven is the one who moved his bed, so Yaakov said to Reuven, you lost your rights to the firstborn, that's going to Yosef. He's getting a double portion of my inheritance, not you. You lost your rights to the kingship, that's going to Yehuda. And you lost your rights to priesthood, to kahuna, and that's still to be decided who that's going to. So, who caused Reuven to lose everything?
Yosef.
If there's one person who should want Yosef dead, it's Reuven. And that's why throughout the story, Reuven is very concerned, because Reuven knows that if they come home and Yosef isn't there, the first person to be held accountable is Reuven. And not just because he's the big brother. Yehuda was the man in charge, even though Reuven was the big brother, but because he was suspect number one. Yes?
Who decided who would be allocated Reuven's birthright? And was Reuven left with anything after losing his birthright?
According to the Chizkuni, it was Yaakov's decision at the time. The verse in Divrei Hayamim in Chronicles records that when Reuven sinned, it was transferred to Yosef and Yehuda. But it's the Chizkuni that interprets that it was Yosef who said it, and Yaakov who decided on the spot to do it, not at the end of his life, but rather earlier. And your other question was?
If Reuven was left with any...
Reuven was left with the basic inheritance, like everyone else. Yes?
So if Reuven hadn't sinned, instead of being called Jews, we'd be called Rubes?
That's not even a question. Later on, specifically, Reuven is still called Yaakov's firstborn in many places in the Torah. And I've read that some commentators take this to mean that even though he lost many things, he was still the firstborn, and he still had some sort of... and he's often mentioned first in the order of
That's
things.
True. That's true. That's true. Yes. Yeah, that's true.
He did do tshuva, right?
We'll see that in a minute. Yeah.
I read somewhere that Reuven knew that Yosef was a complete tzaddik and he would survive when they would throw him into the pit.
Okay, we'll see in a minute.
Why is that a common Jewish name, Reuven? If he was...
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
If he was just so much rebuked.
He was super pious, we'll see. He made a mistake, but he was super pious. We'll see in a minute.
I'm not even like your brother.
So when all the brothers are talking, and Reuven hears what's going on, and Reuven says, nah, why should you spill his blood? Leave him here in a pit in the desert. No one will find him. Why should we actively do this? Now, Reuven's thoughts were, everyone will go to sleep at night. I'll slip back to the pit. I'll take Yosef out, and I'll bring him back home to dad. I'll wait till no one's around. Now, Reuven over here is teaching us a solution to many problems in life. A solution that, if employed correctly, can save a person from the most grave sins.
When he came back, Yosef wasn't there. It was a bad plan.
Okay, maybe. Let's see. I'm not saying it's 100%, but when the Jews are about to sin with the golden calf, what does Aaron tell them? Let's celebrate tomorrow. It didn't work then either, meaning it's not a solution that's foolproof, but one of the keys to dealing with evil inclinations and incorrect decisions is not to take them head on, but rather to delay discussion. Let's talk about it. Thursday night. Yeah. But seriously, there's an element where I do gain by pushing it off to Thursday night. Sometimes a person is very heated with this question. Nothing I say will be accepted. Push them off. We'll talk. You'll see. A kid will sometimes come and say, Dad, I want to pierce my nose. And you're thinking, I'm not sure it's a good idea. You tell him no, he might listen, he might not. You tell him, why don't we discuss it? It's an interesting idea. I want us to look into it a little bit. I want us to understand the repercussions, how many times these things get infected, where's a good place to do this, what you benefit from it. Maybe we should first buy a piece of jewelry that you'll stick into your nose when he appears it. You know, let's do this intelligently. And anyways, while you're getting your nose pierced, I might want to get mine too. You know, he might come off that tree. You never know. Dad, it's not cool. Okay, but at any rate, you win when you can postpone something. The same is true with ourselves. A person sees he's overtaken with desire. He wants to do something wrong. He should tell himself, fine, tomorrow. Tomorrow I'll decide. If I can hold off till tomorrow, I'll have more clarity. The greatest mistakes we make, and that was Reuven's great error, Pachas Kamayim. Reuven was so swift, he said, it's wrong, and I'm dealing now. That's a big mistake. I'll tell you a scary story. I'm on the bus home. It's late at night. I get an SMS, please call. And I look at the SMS and I feel like, it's late. Should I really call? I said, okay, if they want to send the SMS, I'll call. I call. And the family says, you know, we're up, no one's going to sleep. If you can come by, we want to talk to you. Okay, fine. It's already 12:45, but if it's that pressing, okay. Show up, what's the story? They say they just discovered their eldest son is dating an Arab girl, and they've decided to move in together. And they've already formulated the letter in which they write him. They disown him and they never want to see him set foot in the house again. And they just wanted to check halachically if they were right. So I said, no, you're wrong. That's not the way to go. You know, if you force them into that corner, if you're going to tell them, we have nothing to do with you, you want to marry her, goodbye, we're never going to talk to you again. And we don't want to talk to you now that you have an Arab girlfriend. What are you doing? Let's understand where he's coming from. Let's help him understand the repercussions of his discussion. Are you going to win this way? Or are you going to lose this way?
Are these religious people?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So sometimes people are super upset. I was super impressed. You walk into a house, everyone's eyes are bloodshot, everyone's super upset, and they're all seething at this guy, and one of them already told him, don't ever talk to me again, I don't want to ever see your face again. The other one already told him, you know, if I ever meet you again, I'm going to beat you up, and you're not going to walk away without blood. And I say to them, wait, who said, where'd you get all this from? I was impressed that the parents said they wanted to ask a Shiloh before they sent out the letter they had written. I said, come on, let's get together, there's an organization, Yad Lachim, let's talk to them. Understand how you can help them. You're not helping him. You might be very upset at him right now. You're not helping him. Help him. The fact that they paused might have saved the kid's life. We'll find out. Story's not over yet. We'll see. I changed so many facts, you can't put it all together anyways. Yeah. Yeah. Doesn't matter. I changed the facts. I can't tell the stories as is. It's not right. I have to change some facts. Okay. Back to our parsha.
Tell us what happened.
Story's not over yet. I can't finish the story because it's not over yet, but I can say that the enough facts were changed that you'll never be able to trace it. But back to our parsha. They are involved emotionally, but the fact that they had the intelligence to wait before hitting the send button and saying, we wanted to check if we're right, and telling our son this reply, okay, that changed everything. I put them together at that night, you know, at 12:30 at night. I said, there's a hotline, you could call now and consult with people who are experts on this. Discuss with them how you could help your son. But this isn't going to help them any. You're not... Back to our parasha. So Reuven is correcting his mistake where he was so quick to act and he's going to pay for it the rest of his life, and he tells the brothers, wait, we don't have to do this right now. Put him in a pit, let him die on his own. We won't have killed him. And Reuven figures, if I can buy time, I can save him ultimately. And he's right. So when Yosef shows up, and here the Torah does us a great favor. The Torah doesn't tell us in this week's parsha what happened. You have to move forward another two parshiot to see when the brothers start talking about what happened. In the end of Miketz, the brothers start discussing what happened when they were with Yosef by the pit. In this week's parsha, the Torah just says they took off the garments and threw them into the pit. You go to the end of next week's parsha, the brothers start discussing. Yosef was crying, he was begging us, don't do this to me. How could you do this to me? I'm your brother. What's going on here? What's wrong with you? Yosef was pleading and begging, and the Torah leaves it out. The Torah makes it a relatively innocent story. It leaves out the details of the child begging his brothers, save my life. How could you do this, Reuven? How could you do this to me? I'm your brother. Shimon, he's in the pit and he's yelling each one by name, calling them, and the brothers, they sit down to eat, and they can't eat like that. Yosef's yelling. Guys, it was very funny, but you know, I could die down here. God, I always helped you when the brothers were coming down on you. God, how could you not be here for me? Zvulun, come on. He's crying, he's begging, he's not a little boy. And the brothers walk away. They go down to sit down and eat somewhere else. And our sages say that Reuven was busy lamenting his sins. And Reuven told the brothers, guys, I can't eat. You know me, I'm still destroyed over what I did. I have to go continue doing tshuva. And he goes up the mountain for his bodidus. He's going to sit alone to think about his actions. And his plan is to come at night and take Yosef out of the pit.
Why at night? The brothers were away eating.
He didn't think he could get away with it by day. So they're sitting down to eat, and they see in a distance Yishmaeli caravan coming from the city of Gilad. You got to wonder why the Torah tells you where they're coming from. Gilad is a city that traditionally was filled with murderers.
It's an area,
right. And Yehuda decides he's going to save Yosef's life. He doesn't know what Reuven's planning. Yehuda says to them, you know, if we leave him here in the pit to die, yeah, we'll get away with it, but we wouldn't have made any money off of it. Why shouldn't we make some money? Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. We won't have done it, and at the end of the day, he is our flesh and blood. And the brothers accept Reuven, Yehuda's plan. And we'll end with one thought. We're out of time. Our sages say that there are two things. One is Yehuda can convince the brothers by saying, we're not making any money off of this. What a sorry state of affairs. Tov, remind me on Thursday to begin with a story about that. The second point our sages say is that had Yehuda known that the Torah would record this conversation and that every year all the Jewish people would be sitting and reading about this conversation between Yehuda and the brothers, Yehuda would have dived into that pit, picked Yosef up, put him on his shoulders, and given him a piggyback ride all the way home. So that means that sometimes, if we would only think about the idea that what we're doing is being recorded, then we would behave differently. I remember when video cameras first came out, I was out mowing the lawn for my parents, and a neighbor thought it was very cute to videotape me as I was mowing the lawn and collecting the grass and putting out the bags. And I'm working there singing to myself, and for like 5-10 minutes, this neighbor is videotaping me, and I don't know I'm being watched. And an hour or two later, my parents call me in, and they say the neighbor brought over this videotape of me with the dealing with the lawn. And I go over and they show me the videotape, and it felt very awkward. Like, the neighbor's videotaping me, the whole family's watching me doing what? You know, and I'm thinking to myself, and here I am humming a tune as I'm working. Had I known I was being videotaped, how would I behave, right? We come to Shemayim every night, and we come at the end of our lives, and we have a full videotape of everything we did. One of the tools we can use to doing what's right is to think to ourselves, you are being watched. This is being recorded. And there's a large crowd that's watching what's going on here. You'll note sometimes you have a very harsh argument. You answer the phone, okay? Yes. And then you hear it's someone who you really respect or value. And suddenly your tone changes. You can behave very differently. We all have that. You behave one way. That's why when people ask me for recommendations for shiduchim, I always say, next to me, everyone behaves. I don't know. You know, I could tell you what I know. Next to me is a very nice guy. I have a lot of positive things to say, but you got to find out how a person behaves when he's not in the classroom setting. We once had a student here who I gave very strong recommendations for, only to hear that he was seen in the park choking someone. They got into an argument. He was upset at him. He grabbed his throat, started holding tight. So here I am recommending this guy for being a calm, patient, wonderful human being. And then I get this report. What am I supposed to do with myself? Ever since then, I say, look, next to me, people behave. No one chokes anyone. Everyone's nice. I can tell you what I've seen. But the truth is, that's a tool for all of us. Some people put a screenshot on their screensaver of a Rebbe who they hold in high regard. Because they know if they come to the screen and they see him, then they're not going to do what they shouldn't be doing. So some people put a little picture there. It helps. A person has to stop and think for a minute. Use this tool. When Chazal said, had Yehuda known, he would have behaved differently, they were revealing to us how we should view life and use that as a tool to behave more correctly.
Rabbi.